Okay, we are beginning this day with what is perhaps my favorite argument for God's existence. We've gone through ontological arguments, and then last week we looked at the Leibnizian argument for God's existence, and I concluded at least that it rings sort of a hollow sound to it. And so poor Thomas in the cave, you know, is still contemplating his own existence, but we still don't have a clear argument that is more concrete in character. We've been in our own minds for all these months, but the question is there any way to prove that God is really related to the world? And that's really what cosmological arguments are all about. And so since I've already given you sort of a introduction to cosmological arguments, we're going to just jump in and look at the specifically Thomistic argument. Now, do either of you guys know anything about Thomas Aquinas except the few things that I've thrown out here and there? No?
I don't.
Thomas Aquinas, if it weren't for this man, and again, I'm speaking humanly. I'm not, obviously, God could have preserved his church any way he wants, and he didn't need Thomas. But humanly speaking, if it weren't for Thomas, we would probably be worshiping in a mosque. The Muslims advanced into France, were stopped at the Battle of Tours, but this is in the 8th century, and then there was an ongoing war that lasted in the Iberian Peninsula from the 8th century all the way into the 1400s, when they were finally moved out of Granada by Isabella and Ferdinand. But there was also an intellectual movement going on, which was the recovery of Aristotle. And the Muslims in various universities, especially the University of Naples, which was the university of the emperor, and the emperor himself was a skeptic. He actually said, I'm butchering this quote to one degree, but it's a decent paraphrase. He said, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad were all liars. And he didn't mind having Averroists, who were Westerners, teaching in his university. Now, what is Averroism? Averroes was one of the great Muslim philosophers of the 12th and early 13th century. I believe that Averroes died in 1198. So he dies just before the dawn of the 13th century. And Averroes is sort of the Muslim Aquinas. He's their big philosopher. And he is referred to by Thomas as the commentator, because he was the one that gave all these commentaries on the writings of Aristotle. And so Aristotle was reintroduced into Europe in the 12th century via a Muslim named Averroes. And there were several people who took what Averroes was saying and used it as a argument against Christianity. One of the arguments that Aristotle gave is he proved the satisfaction of many, the eternality of the world. And so what Averroes did is he advocated a very symbolic, allegorical interpretation of the Quran, and showed how the Quran and Averroism links. And then he says, since the Bible clearly teaches that the universe had a beginning, the Bible can't be true, the Quran is true, Islam is true, Christianity is false, etc. It was so bad that the Pope had declared a law against reading Aristotle. Now, by reading Aristotle, we mean reading in public, a public presentation of this person's ideas. Well, in walks the Dominicans. The Dominican order was established in 1215, and their whole purpose was to contemplate and give forth the fruits of contemplation. And they were established as a religious order around the year 1215 or 16, just after the Fourth Lateran Council, or probably at the Fourth Lateran Council. They were established, and then they got started within a year or two after that. And Aquinas wasn't even born then. He was born, we believe, in 1224. But We don't know for sure when he was born. We know the year of his death. He died definitely in the year 1274. So this man may have been 50 years old or 49 years old when he died. So I'm 47,
3 years left.
And I have just a few years left, two or three years left. And I feel very intimidated by that because Aquinas's Summa Theologica, if you look at the Blackfriars edition, that's a 65-volume work. The Summa Contra Gentiles is multiple volumes, so is his work on truth. If you take all of his works and line them up, you have about 200, close to 200 volumes. So the man wrote the equivalent of 200 books in the space of, he probably really got going when he was 30. So in the space of 20 years, he wrote about 200 books. And legend has it that he would line up his secretaries and say, one would be doing a commentary on Ephesians, another on one of Aristotle's writings. One was helping him write the Summa Theologica, etc. And he would give a line to one. And as that guy was writing it, he would give a line to the other, give a line to the other, give a line to the other. And when he got back to this guy, he would start the next line. And that's how he wrote some of his books. Is that true? I don't know, but it should be, because it's just a really cool story. But I don't know if it is true. This is he was born in royalty. His father was a count from the county of Aquino, which is an area in Italy. So he's called Thomas de Aquino. He's from Aquino. So Aquinas is not a last name. It's basically the designation of where he lives. And this is why the philosophy of Thomas is not called Aquinianism. It's called Thomism. And it's called Thomism because it wouldn't make sense to call it Aquinianism, because that's really just telling you where he's from, not what his name is. When he was 18, he was enamored with, he goes to the University of Naples at the age of, we believe, around 16, and he was a precocious young boy, and his father was very, he had a lot of older brothers. I think he had 8 older brothers, and his father, and he had a couple of sisters, and his father was very adamant that this young boy, he had already shown that he was very bright by the age of 5, and they started giving him a very intense formal education. His father was grooming him to become the abbot of the local Benedictine monastery in Aquino. So the idea is that here's the Count of Aquino, his father, who's going to raise his son up to give him the monastery. He's going to run the abbey, or the monastery. And then his brother, he had some other brothers like Reginald and some other guys who were actually working under the emperor. And so basically he was trying to consolidate a lot of political power. And he was going to use his son Aquinas, his son Thomas, to gain more power, right? Well, unbeknownst or to the chagrin of the whole family, while Thomas was at the University of Naples, the emperor's university, studying Aristotle formally, he met some Dominicans and joined the Dominican order. He may have joined the Dominican order as early as 18, which would have shown, again, his genius. They saw that he was very bright. They were very eager to have him join this order. His parents were incensed. His brothers came and kidnapped him and locked him in the tower of the family castle for a full year. In fact, one story is that the brothers sent a prostitute up there to seduce him, and he chased her out of the room with a firebrand. The story is that Aquinas was always scared of women, which also proves his brilliance, you know. He's scared of women. And so he chases her out, and a full year he will not take off his habit, which is the Dominican colors, you know, the robe, and it's the white and black robe, right? So he finally, they finally let him out, and not long after he is let out, his father dies, and he actually goes back to Naples, finishes his studies, and then he goes on to the University of Paris and studies under Albert the Great, with some other Dominicans. And the story there goes, there's one story that we think is true again, but we don't know for sure. His Dominican brothers are looking out the window and they say, Thomas, there's a cow sitting in the tree. And Thomas ran to the window to look. And they all started laughing at him. And he turned around and looked at them and he said, I would rather believe that there's a cow in a tree than to think that my Dominican brothers would lie to me. And of course, they felt horrible after that. He was nicknamed, this is funny, he was nicknamed the dumb ox. Why was he nicknamed the dumb ox? Because he took so long to answer questions. Why did he take so long to answer questions? Because when he was given a question, he would think through all the logical possibilities of what the answer would be before he gave you his answer. So he was not quick to speak. And of course, Albert, when he heard of the nickname that the Dominicans had given him, he said, well, you call him dumb ox now, but one day the world will hear his roar. If it weren't for Thomas, Albert would be the guy that we'd be quoting. If it weren't for Thomas, Albert would be the great theologian of the 13th century. Albert was an encyclopedist. He had collected quotes and facts from everything and literally handed this off to Thomas because he saw that Thomas had a great synthetic mind. And so Thomas is the one that takes all of the research of Albert and synthesizes it into this great system, which we know as the Summa Theologica. The Summa Theologica may be the greatest systematic theology ever written. Okay. And I say that as a Protestant who I understand the hesitancy that Protestants have in saying these kinds of things, but the man was a genius. And I quote, I think I quoted two pagans last week, but I think it's good to point out again that Will Durant, who hated Christianity, apologizes for listing Aquinas as one of the great minds of all time. And W.T. Jones, another non-Christian, said, hey, look, this guy had a mind of a Plato and Aristotle. What was Thomas trying to do in his great work? Very simply, he was trying to take the truths of Augustine. And if you were to ask Aquinas, who's the greatest theologian of all time, he would not hesitate. He would say St. Augustine. And he wanted to put those truths in the terms of Aristotle. And so what he gave us was a kind of integrated Aristotelianism where he said, where Thomas is right, we can use him. Where he is wrong, we need to critique him. Well, what's the standard whereby we judge whether Aristotle is right or wrong? Thomas would not hesitate. He would say the Scriptures. Are the Scriptures the sole infallible authority for faith and practice? Yes, says Thomas. He's very explicit about that. So he held to at least a kind of implicit sola scriptura. Was not as well developed as the 16th century reformers, but he would hold to the full material sufficiency of the Scriptures. Whether they were formally sufficient is a different matter. Now, what's the difference between material and formal sufficiency? Material sufficiency means that all of the truths that are necessary for salvation are contained in the Scriptures. Okay? And it's the standard by which we judge all other statements. Formal sufficiency means that the Scriptures are so clear in what they affirm that you don't need a teacher or the church to tell you what the Scriptures say. At least when it refers to the matters pertaining to salvation. Now, you may need a teacher to help you with the book of Revelation, right? Or even maybe with the book of Genesis. Now, that would be disputed in our day. But nevertheless, the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. And that's what is perspicuous or clear to the Christian who opens up his Bible and just reads it. You know how to be saved just by reading the Bible. You don't need a teacher. Now, whether Thomas would sign off on that formal sufficiency of Scripture, that is debated, and I have a feeling that he would not sign off on that. He would say you probably still need the church to explain the way of salvation to you. Okay, so that's where we Protestants would disagree with Thomas. Okay, so anything else about his background? I could go on and on. I have written a little piece for the Aquila Report, if you're interested. About a year ago, I read an article by a pastor who said, you need to avoid Thomas. He's no good, basically. He was just dismissing him. And I got really hot under the collar. So I wrote back a response to him, and I lay out the evidence that Thomas held to a form of sola scriptura, material sufficiency. I demonstrate that Thomas held to a form of sola fide. He actually says we are justified by faith only, very explicitly in his writings. There are qualifications there, and I even say there's some things that Thomas held to that were abhorrent. I think that Thomas is the reason why a Catholic can look at us with a straight face and say that the bread and wine literally become the body and blood of Christ. It's Thomas that gave them the rationale for that, and he used Aristotelian philosophy to justify that crazy doctrine. So when Thomas says things like that, I'm like, on the one hand, I'm amazed at the genius it took to come up with that, and at the same time, I find it abhorrent that he would do that. So he's not somebody we just accept hook, line, and sinker, right? I mean, we have to discern what he said, whether it's true or false, and we need to use the scriptures to do so. But having said that, he is a great gift to the church. He is our greatest mind. He's the greatest mind that the church ever produced, in my opinion. Bar none, I mean, I don't think that there are any close seconds. If I were to give a close second, it would be Jonathan Edwards. In terms of sheer raw intellectual gifting, Edwards is great. But I just have to say Thomas is the greatest mind of the church. He is our Babe Ruth. And he was fat, which makes it very appropriate for me to give that analogy. A fat Italian, you know. But go ahead, you have a question?
So you're saying that Aquinas is actually the one who gives us who gave the Catholic Church, I should say, the doctrine of transubstantiation?
He doesn't give the doctrine. The Fourth Lateran Council solidified it as dogma. And as a true, faithful son of the Church, he feels the need to defend it. What had happened when we enter into the 13th century is that canon law was abysmally contradictory. And so you had different theologians giving different rationales for why the church documents and church laws and theology and all that was such a mess. And some opted for a kind of double truth theory where, and then we actually see this today in Kantian philosophy, and it spilled into modernism. Well, the double truth theory is nothing new. It doesn't start with Kant. It's just that Kant gave the latest expression to this. The double truth theory is the idea that things can be true in theology but false in science. And this is why you have theologians today. They hold to a double truth theory too. They're influenced by Kant. In the 13th century, you had Christians being influenced by guys like Abelard, who preceded Aquinas. He would just say, look, just because I give you a fact and that fact contradicts the scriptures in some area, that doesn't mean that the scriptures aren't true. Because the scriptures are regarding truths of faith, but this scientific fact is regarding a truth of fact. And faith is faith and fact is fact, and the two need never meet. And he gave a very, what I would call an unsophisticated version of that kind of double truth theory that Kant elaborated with great skill and persuaded the modern world that it is so. And that's why you now have today theologians who say, well, even though Jesus never rose from the dead, that doesn't mean Christianity is false. Because Christianity is a matter of faith, not fact. Okay? Well, what Aquinas does is Aquinas battles the double truth theory, and this is one of the reasons why he is very helpful to us. He says all truth meets at the top. And since God is the author of fact and faith, the two cannot be contradictory. Okay? And so it is Aquinas that gave us that. It is Aquinas who said there are some truths that you can actually prove through reason only and that you can't get in revelation. And we always have to remember this. When Aquinas talks about faith and faith and reason, faith is not your inner conviction that something is true. Faith in that context refers to the deposit of faith given in revelation. So it's better to say, when summarizing these matters, reason and revelation. Reason would be those truths that I just get from the material world. So the Krebs cycle in biology, or the movement of the stars in astronomy, I don't get that by reading my Bible. So that is a truth of reason. There are truths of faith that are part of the deposit of faith that I can only get from revelation, like the Trinity or the Incarnation or the way of salvation. And then there are what Thomas called mixed articles, which are things that I can get from both faith and reason. God's existence would be one of them. Thomas would say that I can prove that God exists. Is this a demonstration? Yeah. You mean it's kind of a pointer that kind of gives evidence for God? No. This is an absolute demonstration that God is real. That's what Thomas believed. Modern theologians don't have the guts of Aquinas because they don't want to say that. They want to say, well, these are pointers. I just want to say the evidence shades in that area. It points to it. But they don't want to say proof. Thomas wanted to say proof. Now, he didn't believe it was necessary for you to sign off on the proof or even understand the proof to have genuine faith. God has given a way for all people to come to know him. And that's the way of faith. And here, faith would be that inner conviction that something is true. So Aquinas had no problem with the layperson who had no access to a proof for God, right? He doesn't say you have to wait to hear this demonstration, the scientific demonstration, before knowing God. So in a sense, Aquinas, I think, would be very sympathetic to someone like Plantinga, who says the God is properly basic. I think that Aquinas would be very sympathetic to that kind of thing, because he too doesn't want to say that the people who are out there who are not educated don't have access to God simply because of their lack of education. Okay. Any other questions before I take another step? Yeah, go ahead.
So that principle of the single truth, of all truth meaning at the top, is also what drives him to reconcile this Augustinian theology with Aristotelian philosophy.
Yes. And where Aristotle goes wrong, we say that and we defend the truth against him. Now, I'm not reading all this stuff to you, as you can tell, but now I'm kind of where page 127 is. Aristotle argued that the universe is eternal. And you'll notice that Aquinas, when he gives this argument for God's existence, presupposes the eternality of the universe. Now, why does he do that? Does he do it because he himself believes that the universe is eternal? No, because he is convinced that the Bible teaches creation out of nothing. In Sunday school, we're studying creation now. And we're talking about creation out of nothing. Well, Thomas would agree with all of my interpretations of these scriptures. He would say, yeah, the scriptures clearly teach that the Lord brought the universe into existence out of nothing. But why is he then presupposing the eternality of the universe when proving God's existence? He doesn't believe that you can prove that the universe had a beginning through reason. He doesn't think that that is something that reason can prove. Reason can rebut all arguments against creation from people like Aristotle. So in his book On the Power of God, he goes through over 20 refutations of creation out of nothing. It's amazing what he does. This is brilliant writing. And he could say in two sentences what it takes a lot of people paragraphs to express. The succinctness in which he puts his points is also genius. But he goes through over 20 objections to creation out of nothing, and he rebuts them. He says, reason can defend creation out of nothing in the following sense. Reason can defend it against the objections of the pagans who say that the universe is eternal. However, reason cannot offer a positive proof that the world had a beginning. Does that make sense? So, what does he do? He says, since we cannot prove that the universe had a beginning, and he was aware of the Kalam argument, which we will be looking at soon. I happen to be one of those people who thinks the Kalam argument is sound, right? But I like Aquinas' approach in one sense, because we're arguing against the atheists with our hands tied behind our back. Because what is the number one premise of atheism? That the world has always been here. And Thomas's argument assumes that very premises and says, I'm still going to show you that that God exists, even though the world is eternal. And that is something. By the way, the Fourth Lateran Council not only gave us the doctrine of transubstantiation, but it also declared creation ex nihilo an essential truth of Christianity. And by the way, I happen to agree with the Fourth Lateran Council on that score, because if God is not the creator, it's very easy to fuse God with creation. Unless you're a genius like Aquinas and you can actually make these clear distinctions, people are generally going to confuse the creator with the creature if the creation is just as eternal as the creator is. So even though God, Aquinas thinks you can prove God's existence, assuming the universe is eternal, I also think that you should go the next step and try to show that the universe is not, in fact, eternal. So on the bottom of page 127, I give you this example of two approaches one can take to a cosmological argument. Imagine someone who strikes a match to light a candle. Well, you can say that the person who strikes the match to light the candle, and he's holding the candle, right? So he strikes the match, he lights the candle. You can say he is the original cause of the flame's existence, or you can say he's the originating cause of the flame's existence, right? But also notice that the person who's holding the candle is holding a wax candle that is keeping the wick in place, which is also sustaining the flame. And so you can also say that the person holding the candle is the sustaining cause of the flame's current existence, right? So the Kalam argument is going to try to argue that God is the originator. He is the cause of the creation's original existence. What Thomas is here going to show is that God is the sustainer of the universe, that he is the sustaining or preserving cause of the universe's current existence. Does that make sense to y'all? So what he's giving is what I would call, I'm not the only one that has said this, but this is a vertical cosmological argument. And you have basically a vertical line going like that. That's what he's arguing for. As opposed to a horizontal, Cosmo argument, which is the Kalam argument, which has the moments in time going backwards like that. And what the Kalam argument is going to try to show is there has to be a stopping point in the past. There had to have been a beginning of it all. And Thomas is saying, well, there's no logical reason why that has to be. So the universe could have been eternal. It just so happens that it's not, because God decreed it so. But what you can't deny is that there is a sustaining cause of this chain of causes. Okay? So, let's look at some sample cosmological arguments before we get into the big one. In Summa Theologica, he actually gives a series of arguments, three of which are cosmological in character, and they all kind of yield the same conclusion. It is in the Summa Theologica that he gives his famous five ways. Three are cosmological, one is teleological, and then one is what some people would call rather Platonic. It comes from Aristotle, but it has a Platonic flavor, and that's the argument from perfection. But let's look at this one. This is a cosmological argument, and this may have been Aquinas' favorite argument. It's the argument from motion to an unmoved mover. Things change. That's the first premise. Premise two is whatever changes has the potential for change. Premise three is, but no potential can actualize itself. Premise four, and there cannot be an endless series of actualizers. And that gives us a conclusion. Therefore, there is a first actualizer or unmoved mover who actualizes all change, initiates all motion, and yet is moved by no one. Let's look at another argument. Page 29, or 129. The argument from efficient causes in the world to an efficient cause of the world. And here's the argument. There is an order of efficient causes in the world, but nothing can be the cause of its own being or existence, and no series of efficient causes can cause their own being. Therefore, there must be a first efficient cause of the world. And then there is the argument from contingent beings in the world to the necessary being who causes the world. And here's how this argument goes. Some things exist but can not exist. And something has always existed, but possible beings do not ground themselves. Therefore, there must be a necessary being. And finally, we have an argument that seems to be the heart of the argument of a very little book that Aquinas wrote called De Ente et Essentia, or On Being and Essence. And this is a very, this is like an 80-page book. This is one of his smallest books. And the joke is, it's the favorite book among Thomas because it's the shortest book that Thomas ever wrote, and you can get through it very quickly. But here's the, and there is objections. There's a slight debate as to whether you can discern an argument in the De Ente. But here's what seems to be an interesting argument. Whatever admits of composition is composed by another, and the universe, of course, admits of composition. Therefore, the universe is composed by another. There cannot be an infinite regress of composed composers, and therefore there is a being who is uncomposed or simple and purely actual. And that is what we call God. Now, I'm going to read this part. Many readers, upon encountering these arguments, offer several objections, all of which will be answered in this and the next chapter. But we wish to answer an initial one right here at the beginning of our discussion, namely, that these arguments do not prove the existence of God. For all we know, so the objection goes, each argument may very well give us four different beings: an unmoved mover, an efficient cause, a necessary being, and a simple and purely actual being. But so these arguments, when combined, may very well prove polytheism, not monotheism. The objection, of course, is bogus, since Thomas himself never saw the proofs as completed until he finished his discussion of the attributes of God in the subsequent articles of the Summa. And this is actually part of the problem. Nathan, you're about to head off to seminary, and you may get an anthology. And in the anthology, they will have like a bunch of articles. Say you take a philosophy of religion course, and in that textbook, you'll have, you know, essays from all different writers. Well, and invariably, the third article of Thomas, where he discusses the arguments for God's existence, is in there. And usually, that article just sort of sits by itself. And Thomas didn't see that as the completion of his discussion. He goes on to show that this unmoved mover is God, and that this purely actual being is God. So it's a very, in most colleges, you know, people are like, in fact, when I was in college, I took a course on Christian history, and it was the first time I'd ever heard anything substantially about Aquinas. Aquinas was just some distant name in the past. And I used to say arrogant things as a young Christian, like, oh, if Aquinas had ever read his Bible. You know, I would say stupid things like that. I didn't know that he had actually given multiple commentaries on various biblical books. But this professor said, they almost always do the same thing. The professors that I'm thinking of will say, first of all, they'll give their disclaimer. First of all, I think this is all a matter of faith, and I don't think you can prove any of this stuff because it's really just faith. So that's the first thing they say. And then they butcher the argument. So this professor said, what Aquinas is saying is that, you know, everything has to have a cause, right? So, you know, a guy swings his club and he hits the golf ball. Well, how did that guy get there to hit the golf ball? We had to drive there. Well, how did he drive there? Well, he had to do this. Well, how did he get here in the first place? Well, he was born. Well, that means he came from parents. Well, how did they get here? And you can't go back in time forever. So there must have been a God. And this is not at all what Aquinas was trying to argue. He didn't, like I said, he's not saying that there can't be an infinite number of causes going back in time. Aquinas says it's logically possible that if I were to take a time machine and go back in the past, I may never arrive at a first moment of time. That's a logical possibility. He believes it's a matter of faith, you will, but he doesn't think that that's an impossible thing. So notice that the professor says two things. First, I think it's just a matter of faith. Well, how do you know that? How do you know it's just a matter of faith? Well, because all the arguments fail. Okay, well, give me an argument that fails. Well, Thomas's arguments fail, obviously, because this idea of a past eternal not being possible is stupid. And Thomas never said that, so you butchered Thomas's argument, and you closed yourself off to the idea that you can prove your point of view. That doesn't sound like it's very rational to me for you to do that. So it is frustrating, but those are two of the problems. First, most people butcher his argument, and second of all, they think Thomas thinks that he's proving everything he needs to about God in that one article on the proofs for God, which only takes up, if you put it in side columns, that only takes up one page. That whole article takes up one page. It shows the succinctness of the arguments and how genius he was at just putting his points very succinctly. But at the same time, it doesn't, because the modern reader needs things fleshed out more, it doesn't help the modern reader because they don't really understand the kind of metaphysical assumptions that Thomas has going into the argument. And so here's what I would like to do. I would like you to hear my own version of Thomas's proof for God's existence, where I'm going to actually take all of these things and put them together into one single proof that not only proves an uncaused cause, but proves that the uncaused cause just is everything Christians or Muslims or Jews, classical monotheists have said about God. Okay, so that's the argument that we're all going towards here. So would you like to ask a question before? Okay, so at the bottom of page 130, I give you my argument. We're going to go through this fairly carefully. We're not going to miss a beat, okay? Here's the argument. Premise A, at least one contingent thing undeniably exists. Premise B, that which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. Premise C, at least one thing exists that is being caused by another. Premise D, an infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. Premise E, the cause of all contingent things cannot be caused by another. Premise F, the cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. Therefore, G, there is at least one uncaused sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. H, the uncaused cause of contingent reality is eternal, necessary, immutable, unlimited, independent, omnipotent, one, omnipresent, immaterial, omniscient, truth, omnibenevolent, love, life, impassible, and personal. He is transcendent and immanent, perfect and simple, immense, beautiful, happy, incomprehensible, and yet knowable. I, the uncaused cause is everything the God of classical monotheism is. Therefore, J, the God of classical monotheism exists. Ha. Now, that's meant to be provocative in one sense. There's the argument. So the question is, are these premises true? And the first question that my students usually say is, how do you know that this being is happy? Okay. So we are going to very carefully march through these premises. So for the remainder of our time in this first hour of study, I'm going to try to get you to premise D. The heart of the argument are those first four premises. Is it the case that at least one contingent thing exists? Is it the case that contingent things need causes? And then can there be an infinite regress of such contingent things? That's the real issue. And you'll notice that when you flip over the page, I go into a very long, drawn-out discussion of that first premise that lasts for pages and pages. I'm not going to read everything I say in these pages, okay? And some of you are very happy about that. I am going to summarize. I'm going to read some parts of this and then just explain other parts. But I think that this premise, is not only undeniably true, I think it's actually too weak. It doesn't really describe the way things actually are. And here's what I mean by that. I don't think that it's just the case that one contingent thing exists. I think that there are many, many contingent things. But all I need is one contingent thing to base build my argument off of. If I can establish the existence of one contingent thing, then the argument can get rolling whether there is more than one or not. But I'm getting ahead of myself. At least one contingent thing exists, or one contingent thing undeniably exists. And the question is that true? Well, we need to break that up into really two parts. First of all, I want to argue that we know undeniably that something exists. And then I want to argue that that which we know is existent is contingent. Okay? So let's ask the first question, or raise the first question. Is it the case that something exists, and is that undeniable? Raise your hand if you think that something does not exist, or if you think that nothing exists. By the way, if you raise your hand, you'll prove my point, because hands have to exist to be raised, and therefore something exists. I mean, whenever I state the words, I do not exist, I find myself existing as I state my denial, and therefore something exists. Existence is an intuitive notion, and so we kind of define existence more ostensibly than we do by definition, because any definition I give of existence presupposes what? The existence of something, right? So we usually say, well, existence is that which is, or the thatness of something, or the there-ness of something, or the awareness of something. But, I mean, we don't really have a definition of existence unless you want to follow Bishop Berkeley, who argued that to be is to be perceived. He gave the first analytical definition of existence that we know of, at least. Okay, fine. To be is to be perceived. So, and if you broaden out perception to include all kinds of things, not just your eyes, but feeling and that sort of thing, then yeah, most people would say, yeah, okay, to be is to be perceived. I don't really feel comfortable with that definition. I think existence is even more intuitive than that. So we just know what it means to exist. Something is. You can't deny that something is. And this is based on sensation, right? This book that I'm writing exists. I can see it. It has pages, so on. I can see you guys. And as I said before, there's a transcendental argument for the existence of something. Because if I state that I don't exist, I find myself existing as I state the denial. The idea that everything is pure illusion begs the question, who's having the illusion? And that means that something has to be suffering from the illusion. And so even the Hindu who says that all is Maya can't be right about that absolutely. In fact, he would be the first to admit that he's not right about that absolutely. Something exists. He just wants to say that the world that we perceive is illusion. I want to say that the perception, the world that we're perceiving, the perceptions we have are real perceptions of things that really exist. And even if I suffer from illusions from time to time, there must be an I who suffers from it. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Wouldn't it also require that the illusions themselves do still have a cause or a caster?
Yes, very good. So we're getting a little ahead of things here, but very good. The contingency of our world is not negated by the fact that there may be illusions. So, for example, let's assume that I am suffering a complete cognitive breakdown in the sense that everything that I perceive is illusory. Well, that proves, does it not, that I'm contingent and that there's a causal relationship here because I am suffering from an illusion. Something is causing the illusion to be. So the illusions are contingent. And the cause itself, since the cause is me in this case, and since my sense perception is extremely limited, obviously, because I'm suffering from illusions all the time, that proves my contingency as well. It proves the limitations of my sense perception. It proves that they are potentially defective. They are defective in many respects, right? Okay. So how are we doing so far? Are y'all convinced that something exists? Okay. Well, on page 134, say, I know that something exists. I exist. The book that I'm writing exists. You guys exist. But I also know the general characteristics of the things I perceive in the world, the things that I perceive in the world, namely that the things which exist in the world are contingent. Now, up to this point, I have not defined that term. So my question to you is, what does it mean to say that something is contingent? And it's very simple. Something is contingent just in case it is finite or limited, it is mutable or changing, and it is dependent upon something else for its existence. That's what we mean by contingent. And if you think about it, if you're one, you're the other. So if you're changing, you're obviously dependent. And if you are limited, you're obviously dependent as well. But my first question is this, and you can ask this of yourselves. You're the one contingent thing you know, right? With absolute certainty. And how do you know that you're contingent? Well, I look at myself and I say, okay, I'm limited. I'm limited in knowledge. There was once a time that I didn't even know what the word contingent meant. I'm limited in space. I can't be everywhere at once. I'm limited in power. I've been to the weight room. I've seen guys bench press more than me, right? And I've tried to bench press certain weights and have failed and was very thankful for the guy spotting me, right? Have you ever been through something like that? I can't run as fast as other people. And I can run faster than other people. So I know that I have power, but my power is not greater than others, but it is more than others. So I know that I have a degree of power. And the very fact that I have a degree of power means that I'm limited in power. I'm limited in knowledge. I'm also limited in goodness. I've not done the things that I always know is the right thing to do. I'm dependent upon other things for my existence, aren't I? I depend upon oxygen for my existence. I depend upon the sun for my existence. I depend upon food. Humans, in general, depend upon community for their existence. Have you ever seen a guy? I've never seen this, but I've heard, read stories about guys that were trapped on deserted islands for months. And when they were finally recovered, they were literally insane. Did y'all see the movie Castaway? Mm-hmm. Why does he create an imaginary friend called Wilson? To keep himself from going crazy. I mean, that's exactly why he does that. He talks to Wilson. He has to have something external that he has to talk to. So our minds were built to be social. Why is it that I'm not content to just write this argument out in my study and just sort of just leave it at that? I'm a social creature. I got to share what I've created here with you guys, with other people. Why don't you just sit in your room and play the guitar, Nathan? Just play it, just strum the guitar.
I do sometimes.
Yeah, you do. But you're not content with that. I sit in my room all by myself and type up these things. You sit in your room. I listen to Evan all the time strumming his guitar in his room by himself. But you guys are not content to express your art just to yourselves. You want to express your art to a community. It's very natural for people to share what they've created with other people. So the human beings are social creatures. We depend upon community for our existence. We depend upon oxygen, food, the sunlight, and so forth, shelter. So we are dependent beings, aren't we? Yeah. Are we changing? Well, I'm heavier than I once was. I'm taller than I once was. And I have less hair on my head. Although for some strange reason, I gain more hair in all the other parts of my body. There are many parts of my body right now that have hair that I wish hair was not there. And the top of my head, where I want a lot of hair, it seems to be going away. I find this very perplexing.
Oh, rescue me from this body of death.
All right, so have I convinced you guys that contingent things actually exist? Is there at least one contingent thing then? I think we can come up with many examples of contingent things. Now, let me give you two more definitions of contingency, and this will help us along the way. The first definition of a contingent thing is, I've given you the first. The first is something that is limited, changing, and dependent. But a second definition, which is a little bit more, it's not wordy, it's actually less wordy, it's simpler, but it is invoking Aristotelian language, okay? And here it is. A contingent thing is a thing that is composed of actuality and potentiality. I give that definition on page 136. A contingent thing is a thing that is composed of actuality and potentiality. And you'll notice that that's, again, just a matter of common sense. Think about yourself. Do you exist? Most of you've already told me yes. Something exists. I exist. Well, do you have potential in your being? Well, yeah. There are dreams that you have that you want to fulfill and that you actually see them in your grasp, don't you? That means, doesn't that mean that you have potential? You have unfulfilled potential in your being? There are things that you are that you're not, that you could be. There are things that you once were that you could be again if you would just do X, Y, or Z. So the point I'm making is this. You actually exist, but you have the potential to be other than what you are. You have the potential to die. You have the potential to not be. You also have the potential to get stronger. With modern technology, you actually have the potential to be taller and to have more hair on the top of your head than you actually have. I have the potential to shave my beard. And if I shaved it, I would have the potential to grow it. So I am an actual being that has a lot of potential. I am a composed being of actuality and potentiality. Does that make sense? Now, if we want to ramp it up just a little bit more, and this is not in what I've written here, we can say that a contingent thing has a real distinction of essence and existence. In fact, this is the heart of what we would call the Thomistic metaphysic. So if you are a Thomist, one of your staple assumptions about the world is that the world you live in has a real composition of essence and existence. What it is not the same thing as the fact that it is. Those things are really distinct. And if you think about it, the very fact that you're composed of actuality and potentiality means that your essence is not the same thing as your existence. That means that you don't have to be, right? That's basically what that is saying. That's basically what it means to be a composition of essence and existence. The what you are and the that you are had to be composed in some way by another cause. Right? All right, how are we doing so far? On page 136, I do go on a slight tangent, and I want to read this out to you. So it's the last paragraph. I allude to the Buddhist philosopher Gunapala Dharmasiri, or at least I discuss him, who I think misunderstands our first premise. He presses an objection to our contingency argument by insisting that the terms impermanence and change have empirical and factual meaning, while the term contingency does not. Dharmasiri must defend the concept of impermanence as an empirical fact because in the Buddhist worldview, dukkha, impermanence, imperfection, insubstantiality, suffering, emptiness, is the first noble truth. This first noble truth sets forth the fundamental human predicament of suffering. And unless one recognizes the fact of impermanence, one will never be able to attain enlightenment. Buddha was also an empiricist, believing that all knowledge is attained through the senses. Thus, it was extremely important for him to set up empirical constraints upon the meanings of various terms. However, as we have labored to prove in this premise, contingency is simply another term for dukkha, or impermanence. Indeed, we have seen time and again that our world is one of mutability, limitation, and dependency. And that which is contingent is, by definition, that which is limited, changing, and dependent. In other words, the word contingent is really just a more fleshed-out term, a richer term, than mere dukkha. Contingency is not mere impermanence, although it includes that. And notice that I grounded this in experience. I'm not arguing from concepts. I'm arguing from what is true existentially. This is why I'm pushing for the existential undeniability of God's existence. because it's grounded in what is true of our existence as empirically or experientially confirmed. So this argument is rooted in the soil of our undeniable experience as contingent things. Everything we encounter in our experience is composed of actuality and potentiality. Everything we experience could not be. Thus, everything we experience is contingent. To distinguish between impermanence and contingency is to make a distinction without a difference. Dharmacharya also insists that for the Buddhist, the world is not a thing, but a vast series of evanescent changes. But this perspective, even if true, would not undermine our fundamental point in the premise. Contingent things exist. At best, it would only force us to word it more carefully. Observable reality is impermanent, or it is undeniable that our experience is made up of a vast series of evanescent changes or contingencies. And so, in other words, I could argue with a Buddhist empirically and say, what you're trying to say is what I'm trying to say. Now, the Buddhist would not be comfortable with the idea of essence because the Buddhist doesn't think that an essence really exists. Well, that's fine. I mean, I don't really have to establish that here. The point is that contingent things do exist, and that's all that you need for this. You can define contingency in a number of ways. It all amounts to the same thing. There are distinctions within the things that we see, actuality and potentiality, limitation, change, and so forth. So, the purpose of this premise was to show that at least one contingent thing exists, and we think we have proved more than the premise demands. We pointed out, first of all, that the affirmation that something exists is a precondition of thought. One must presuppose that something exists in order to be assured that experience is intelligible. Also, total illusion is impossible. Finally, the assumption that sense perception is basically reliable is an indispensable assumption that we all have. If a person looks at me and says, well, your whole argument is dependent upon sense perception being reliable, and I don't grant the reliability of sense perception, what would I say to that person? I would say, I don't hear you. I can't hear what you're saying. Because our senses inform us of an outside or mind-independent world of trees, stars, and books, we can be sure that something exists. And then we noted that we live in a world of change, limitation, and dependency. And everything we observe is composed of actuality and potentiality. In short, we cannot deny the contingency of our experiences. Thus, at the very least, one contingent thing exists. In light of the fact that this assumption is so basic and undeniable to all of us, we may safely move to the second premise of our argument, and that is that that which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. But you'll notice this when I'm doing through this entire argument. If you look at footnote 12, where I say one contingent thing undeniably exists, footnote 12 says, the viewpoint known as pantheism, which says that everything is necessary, there are no really contingent things, has just been eliminated. You see, Thomas's argument is a direct proof of God, but it's an indirect proof of all the other worldviews. The transcendental argument is an indirect proof of God and a direct disproof of all the competing worldviews. So this is why they complement each other so well. All right, now, do you have any questions before we go to the next step? You're convinced that the first premise is true then. That which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. The first issue that we have to confront is, what does it mean to say that something is a cause of something else? And the second thing we have to address is, are contingent things currently caused to exist? So what is a cause? Well, a standard dictionary definition is that a cause is that which produces an effect, or the necessary and sufficient conditions of an effect. But a more thorough definition is that a cause is that which actualizes the potential of another, or that which affects a transition from potentiality to actuality. Okay? A chair has the potential to exist, but a chair doesn't just exist, does it? You have to have a cause of the chair. So we would say that a carpenter is the cause of a chair's existence in the sense that he is the one that produced the chair or caused the effect. Or, better still, the carpenter is the one who actualized the potential of the chair to exist. Now, ever since Aristotle, we have distinguished six kinds of causes, and this is really important. This, by the way, will help you with theology when you're in all kinds of areas. Knowing the sixfold order of causes is an extremely important way of you understanding all kinds of things, not only in philosophy, but science, theology, and so forth. The first kind of cause is an efficient or primary cause, that by which a thing exists, or the ultimate explanation of an effect. The exemplary cause is that after which, or the pattern after which an effect is produced. The formal cause, that of which, is the form of the effect. The material cause, that out of which, that is the stuff out of which the effect is produced. The instrumental cause, that through which, that would be the tool or the tools used to produce the effect. And then the final cause, that for which, is the purpose for which the effect exists. So, let's apply this sixfold notion of causality to the carpenter. We would say that the carpenter himself is the efficient cause of the chair's existence. He's the precondition for the efficiency of all the other causes, and thus the precondition for the chair's existence. His drawing or blueprint of the kind of chair he wants to make is the exemplary cause. The form, like a rocking chair, that the chair will take is the formal cause. The wood from which the chair is constructed is the material cause. And the tools the carpenter uses to make the chair, that would be the instrumental cause. And then having a place to sit down is the final cause. That's the purpose for which the chair exists. Now, here's an important point. When seeking for the cause of contingent things we observe in our world, we are mainly interested in discovering the efficient cause or causes of these contingent things. For if the reader will notice carefully, every other kind of cause we have mentioned is itself contingent in some way. The exemplar or exemplary, formal, material, instrumental, and final causes of the chair are themselves effects of the primary or efficient cause. Who is the ultimate explanation of their function? In short, we may speak of these other causes as secondary causes, which are themselves products of one primary cause. That said, it should be obvious that any explanation of the chair that rests solely in the chair's secondary causes is no real explanation. These secondary causes do give us an approximate explanation of the chair, but they fail to give us an ultimate explanation of the chair. Likewise, if we are to seek for an explanation of the existence of contingent things in our world, then we must explain them in terms of efficient causality, not final or formal, material, instrumental, or exemplary causality. Of course, at this point, we're begging the question, why seek an explanation of contingent things in the first place? Why think that a contingent thing needs a cause? So I ask all of you, why do you think that a contingent thing has to have a cause? And I'm going to just throw that at you. Why?
So you've already defined a contingency as something that is just in case, something that possesses both actuality and potentiality.
Yes.
I don't feel like I'm saying something new here that hasn't been said before in the writing, so I'm kind of cheating. But in order for something to move from the potential to the actual, something has to actually move it. Like, there has to be something that transitions the potential to actuality. And if we're saying, by definition, a contingent being or item cannot move itself from potentiality to actuality, then there must be some kind of external cause or entity.
Very good. What you're saying is the potentials cannot actualize themselves. I look at a bucket and it's full of water. And I say, well, why is it full of water? And you say, well, it has the potential to be so. Does that explain why it's full of water? The mere potential of the bucket to be filled with water does not explain why it does. And also, if you say that the reason, the explanation for why the bucket is filled with water is because it is full of water, what you're really saying is that it is either necessary that it be filled with water, it could not be otherwise, or another way to say it is this: the bucket caused itself to be full of water. And you have to rule out both, right? Our experience with buckets is that they don't have to be full of water, because I can go up to any bucket full of water and empty it, right? So no bucket has to be full of water. And second of all, you can't have a self-caused entity. There's no such thing as self-caused potentialities or anything like that. Why? Because you can't exist before you exist. So let's unpack all of that. If you say that my existence is caused by the sheer fact that I do, and you're saying also that I can not exist, you're saying two things at once. You're saying Travis Campbell is an insufficient explanation of himself, and he's the very explanation that he needs. And that is what we mean by self-causality. And you see the contradiction there? So even if I were hypothetically eternal, and we know I'm not, but let's say that I were, even if I were eternally existent as an actual potential thing, my eternality would be purely accidental, because I could not exist. From all eternity, I could not exist. So what explains the fact that I do exist? Well, it's not the fact that I exist, because I could not exist, right? So what explains the fact that I exist? Well, there has to be an external cause to my existence. Otherwise, you're going to say, I lack an explanation for myself, and I completely explain myself at the same time and in the same sense. And we can't say that. That's a contradiction. And that's what we mean by self-causality. A self-caused thing is something that needs a cause and is the cause it needs. So self-causality is not only contradictory in a temporal and in a temporally logical way, because if I walk up to a couple and I say, boy, that's an interesting house that you're building, or that's an interesting house, what caused the house to exist? And the couple said, oh, no one caused it, it produced itself, we would immediately know that they're lying, because you can't exist before you exist temporally. But you also cannot exist before you exist ontologically or by nature, right? In other words, to say it yet again, you can't need a cause and only to be the cause you need. Now, I could hypothetically be uncaused. Is there any contradiction in the idea of an uncaused thing? There's no contradiction in an uncaused thing. And I'll even give you an example. There are different schools of thought on the nature of numbers. Some believe that they exist, and some believe that they do not exist. But I think all of us would agree that if a number did exist, if the number 2 actually existed in the abstract realm somewhere, then its existence would be uncaused, right? It's not self-caused. The number 2 doesn't bring itself into existence, but it's not caused to exist either by something other than itself, if it literally exists. Does that make sense? And I'm talking about numbers existing in some Platonic realm, the eternal realm of forms, right? And now we might look at each other and go, yeah, that's kind of crazy to think that numbers exist. So we don't believe that they do exist. You gotta prove to us that numbers exist. Fine. But the point is that if they did exist, they would be uncaused. And there's no contradiction in that notion of something just existing without a cause. There is something contradictory in the notion of something bringing itself into existence or sustaining itself in existence. Isn't there? You can't sustain your existence any more than you can create your existence. Why? Because you can't need a cause only to be the cause you need. How we doing? Yeah.
So from a philosophical perspective, how would we deal with the concept of human self-actualization? In other words, kind of people drawing out their own potential physically, mentally, emotionally. You know, like if you need to gain knowledge, you study. You draw out the potential for which you can fill your mind with. If you need to get stronger, if you need to improve your body, you exercise, you diet. If you need to improve your emotional health, you see a psychologist or a doctor.
I have an earful to give you about that. But on page 142, I actually have a footnote that answers a similar objection to what you just gave. So I'll put it to you like this. A man desperately hanging on the side of a cliff with his own hands and arms, by, for that matter, is indeed trying to preserve his own life. But technically, this man is sustaining his own position, not his own existence. That is being done by oxygen, the food in his stomach, and so forth. So it's one thing to say that I can determine my placement, but I can't determine my existence. Right? So oxygen is sustaining me existence, whether I move myself from here to there. Now again, I have an earful to say, and there's a lot that Thomas wants to say about that. But I think that for our purposes, that might be just a sufficient answer.
This might be a little crude, but
yes, sir.
People have the potential to off themselves, and mm-hmm. people actually do. It's
right.
not a ceasing of mm-hmm. existence being controlled by that person.
It may, but notice the ceasing isn't just that person. That ceasing to exist, a number of causes have to come into play. For example, the bullet, the instrumental cause has to be used to end your own existence, for example. So the fact that I'm being sustained in existence by various causes isn't negated by the fact that I can off myself, that I can kill myself. It doesn't disprove the fact that I cannot sustain my own existence. It may prove that I can end my own existence. For example, the man hanging on the cliff can let go, right? And he can contribute to the ending of his own existence. But notice, he's not the only cause in that factor either. Gravity has to take effect. If gravity were to all of a sudden just stop, even his letting go would mean that he just doesn't have control. So a lot of people in their existences, quote unquote, and we're assuming that there's no life after death for this, right? And by the way, show me an atheist who believes in life after death, and I'm going to show you a very strange fellow. And this is an argument against those who reject the supernatural altogether. And that, of course, would lead us into a whole lot of other issues. But assuming that there is no life after death makes this argument all the stronger because it shows the radical contingency of our existence. And I don't think the fact that I can kill myself disproves my contingency, nor does it disprove the fact that any contingent thing in existence requires a cause. Even if those contingent things can act in such ways that they, along with other causes, end their existence. Yeah.
So our attempts at quote-unquote self-actualization are still contingent upon external factors.
Sure.
So improving knowledge would still require that we get a book or that we find somebody
and you can't,
else who knows something we don't.
Remember. Not, I mean, you have to be warm enough to move to go get that book. Well, that means you have to have the sun. You also have to have the sun to see that book and to read it. So the knowledge you acquire from the book is dependent upon other causal factors as well. How are we doing? Is this persuasive to you? Are you granting that contingent things exist and that contingent things need causes? I mean, think of the way we defined it. A contingent thing is not only an actual with potential, and potentials, since they can't actualize themselves, need causes. We also said that a contingent thing is a dependent being. Well, to say that you're dependent upon other factors for your existence automatically means that you need a cause. Now, this is what led one atheist to say to me, yeah, but then that means it's just a tautology. You know, you're just defining a contingent thing into existence. And I said, no, I'm defining a contingent thing. The proof that it does exist is proved experientially. So I get a start of the argument with the second premise. I could say, whatever is contingent needs a cause for its existence. And I could have defined a contingent thing and then shown how contingent things need causes. And that would have proved at all that there are contingent things.
Why not prove at first that the atheist is contingent? Just do that.
Right. Well, the atheist has to admit that he's contingent. He's a contingent reality. But see, there are atheists out there, they'll look at the second premise and say, that's just a tautology. You're still stuck in your head. You're still giving a purely conceptual argument. Well, the argument that contingent things need causes may be a conceptual argument. But obviously, and that's a logical argument. In other words, this is a logically necessary truth or an analytical statement to say that if you're contingent, you need a cause. Right? But that doesn't mean that I haven't proven anything real, because the first premise proves that contingent things really exist. So either I know by my undeniable experience that things are contingent, and I know conceptually, given what a contingent thing is, that it has to have a cause. It has to have a cause for its existence. All right, so how are we doing so far? I want to give you a quote. Well, notice on page 143, I give the following argument, and this may be a good summary. A contingent thing is either self-caused, uncaused, or caused by another. But no contingent thing is either self-caused or uncaused. Right? And how do we know that? We know from experience that contingent things are not uncaused. And we know logically that no contingent thing can be self-caused, because nothing can be self-caused. A self-caused thing is as impossible as a square circle. And so I give you a quotation of the greatest critic of the contingency argument in history, who signs off on this premise. Immanuel Kant said this. He said, and this is at the bottom of page 143, if, therefore, a thing is assumed to be contingent, it is an analytic proposition to say that it needs a cause. In other words, it's true by definition. Now, if you look around enough on YouTube, you'll find a Sunday school class with William Lane Craig. He's teaching Sunday school. And I'm there. And I raised my hand and I asked him, well, since Immanuel Kant said that it's analytically true to say that contingent things need causes, and Craig goes like, whoa, 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 Kant never said that. And he explained to me that what Kant believed is that contingency is a kind of idea in the mind, and contingent things could exist without causes. It just so happens that they don't, or it's just sort of a presupposition we have that we take to the data around us and that sort of thing. Well, if you look at that page, I went back home and I looked it up. If you look at that page, what you'll see Kant doing is he's giving two different definitions of contingency. A contingent thing can be defined either logically, in terms of I can logically conceive of it as non-existent, or it can be defined through experience, in which case there's dependency that is caught up in the definition of what a contingent thing is. And if you assume that a thing is actually contingent, meaningly that it is an actually dependent being, then it's analytically true to say that it needs a cause. And that's the definition we're working off of here, because we're arguing from experience. Does that make sense? Now notice also, and this is the under the qualification summary and review, you'll notice also that the contingent things that exist that need causes, they don't need causes for their origin. They need causes for their existence right now. What if oxygen were to be taken out of my body right now?
It would cease to exist.
I would cease to exist. So it's not that I once was dependent upon oxygen for my existence, but now I'm okay. I don't need oxygen anymore. No. I need oxygen right now. Remove that cause, I don't exist. So what we're talking about is our right now kind of cause. Once contingent, always contingent. Therefore, if anything is contingent, it needs something to conserve it in being. Or else, if it doesn't have that cause, it's not going to be in being. And this is why I need to introduce you to another important feature in Thomistic metaphysics. Thomas made a distinction between an accidentally ordered series and an essentially ordered series. What's the difference? Well, I go outside into my backyard, especially when Evan was young and he was wont to leave things in the backyard, and I see a soccer ball. And I walk around the yard with a stick and I move the soccer ball, right? So you see me moving the soccer ball with the stick. That would be an example of an essentially ordered series. Because the stick, the ball is moved by the stick, which is moved by the hand, which is moved by my will, and so forth, right? And it ends with an essentially ordered, it ends with an essential cause. Something's movement is essentially connected to the ball's movement. If I stop moving my hand, what happens to the ball? It stops moving. All right. So it's an essentially ordered series. The ball's movement is essentially connected to that order of causes. Does that make sense? But there's also an accidentally ordered series. The accidentally ordered series would be something like me and my relationship to my own father. My father is responsible, my mother as well. My father and mother were responsible for my coming into existence. Right? But my mother died when I was 8. Did I cease existing when she died? So I'm accidentally ordered to my mother because my mother can cease existing and I can go on. My father may die before me, but I will go on, maybe more sadly than before, but I will go on even after his death. So my existence is not dependent upon the originating cause of my existence. But my existence is dependent upon this essential series that I'm talking about. Me, oxygen, and so forth. Does that make sense? All right, how are we doing? This is, by the way, why Thomas doesn't believe that the Klom argument works. Because temporal moments lined up in time are accidentally related to each other. And therefore, you don't need a first creative cause of the universe's being. But he would say you need a first uncaused, sustaining cause of the universe's being. But that leads us to premise C, at least one thing is caused by another. That means that there are things in this world that are effects, and they are effects of causes. Now, what does that mean? That means that there is more than one thing in the universe. Right? Because if I require an external cause of my existence, then there has to be at least two things in the world. And I just demonstrated that two worldviews are false. I've refuted skepticism because skepticism says that the law of causality is unjustified. And I've also refuted a worldview called solipsism, which says that I am the only thing that exists. I'm not the only thing that exists precisely because, A, solipsists write books. That would be one refutation. And then second of all, solipsists need causes for their existence, and therefore they can't be the only thing that exists. Yeah.
Remember when I heard about solipsism in college, I always wondered what their meetings must be like.
Right.
A bunch of people sitting in the circle, and each one of them is thinking to themselves, oh, poor suckers. None of them realize they don't exist.
Right, exactly. All right, so on page 145, I give a summary of the first three premises. In premise A, we concluded that contingent things undeniably exist. I cannot deny my own existence, nor can I consistently deny the reliability of what my senses tell me. If my senses tell me that this book exists, then I should believe that the book exists. We also concluded that both myself and the book are contingent existences. We are both changing, limited, and dependent upon other things. The book currently depends on me, and I currently depend on the book. I can currently depend on oxygen and so forth. And each contingent thing is such just in case it is composed of actuality and potentiality. The book actually exists as the potential not to. I actually exist as the potential not to. In premise B, we concluded that what is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. This premise simply makes explicit what was implicit in premise A. Indeed, if one concludes that dependent things exist, then one must conclude that those dependent things have causes. And that leads us to affirm premise C, at least one caused entity or effect exists. But if something exists that is caused by another, then there must be an other upon which it depends. In other words, once we conclude that one contingent thing exists, we must conclude that there are other contingent things upon which it depends. There cannot be just one thing. Therefore, there is at this moment a series of contingent things in existence, each thing being dependent upon another for its existence. The series exists as a series of contingent effects or caused causes. The series is as follows. The book is currently being caused to exist by me. I'm the one who places limits on the volume. I am being caused to exist by oxygen, and the stars and some atomic particles made the existence of oxygen possible, and so forth. Okay, so you get this? We have a series of vertical caused effects going on like this. Cause, causes, or contingent effects. It doesn't matter how you put it. Okay? So the next premise is the key. This is the key premise to the whole thing. If you accept this one, then naturalism at the very least is done for, if not atheism altogether. An infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. And again, I remind you of the series. I'm writing this book, I'm being caused by oxygen, and there's a series going on here. And it's causally related to each other. How are we doing so far? Now, we have several options here. And I'm going to get rid of this here and these words here just so I can make this point. Here's our series. It's like links on a chain, right? Let's assume, first of all, that this series of causes is finite in number. There's only a limited number of causes. What must we conclude if that number is finite? If it's finite, then does it end somewhere?
Yes.
It has to end in something that is, well, uncaused, right? Whether it's infinite or not, we'll hold off. But it has to end in something, at least one thing that is uncaused, right? So like you have chains, a link of chains, and it's hanging on the peg on the wall.
Although is it not logically possible that chain could go on forever?
Very, very good. It was too easy, right? So our first assumption is that it's a finite number of causes. Well, that's just too easy, right? So let's get rid of that. I mean, we don't want to make it that easy for us. So, and it's logically possible, and Thomas would agree, that the number of contingent things is actually infinite. So there's an actually infinite number of contingent links going all the way up and all the way down. So you have an infinite number of causes. Well, now what must we conclude? Let me read what I have to say on page 146. It's the very last paragraph on that page, and here's what I say. Let's assume that the series of causes is infinite in number. That is, whenever we reach a contingent thing, we discover that there is yet another contingent thing sustaining it ad infinitum. It keeps going and going and going. And that would be true going upwards at the causes of me here on, or the things that I'm causing, maybe, you know, the particles that are dependent on my body right now, all the bacteria that live in my stomach, all that stuff. So if I go down to the macro level, it's turtles all the way up. And if I go on the micro level, it's turtles all the way down. So it's an infinite number going either way. Does that make sense? Even on this assumption, there are only two conclusions that we can reach with regard to the contingent series. We could say that the series, though its individual members are caused to exist as a whole, exists without a cause. Two, we could say that there is something uncaused existing outside of the infinite series of contingent causes. Those are our two options. A close analysis of these two options indicates that option two is more reasonable. Now, go to the footnote, and I say this. In an earlier draft of this argument, one reader, who happens to be a professor that I had at Westminster, he read this, and he was unhappy with me for giving a Thomistic argument in the first place. One reader insisted that I failed to offer all the alternatives available. One could say that the uncaused being, or group of beings, there's a bunch of uncaused beings, right? You could say that they exist outside of the contingent series, or that the series as a whole is without a cause, or simply that everything that exists is caused or contingent. Why don't you just say everything is contingent? Everything that exists is contingent. By the way, that's atheism. The pantheist says nothing is contingent. The atheist says everything is contingent. And why don't you just leave it at that? If everything is caused, then there is no need for an uncaused being to sustain them. If this objection were valid, then our argument would be refuted before it even got off the ground. However, this third option is really nothing more than a veiled expression of the proposition that the series as a whole is without a cause. Yeah.
But don't you have to change the very definition of what it is to be contingent for that even to work?
That's exactly where I'm heading with this argument.
Okay.
So as I unpack it, tell me if I'm not going where you're going with your question.
To say that everything is contingent, I mean, that is, I mean, there has to be, if you hold to that definition that we established earlier, that it's limited, that it's mutable, that it's dependent, well, that doesn't really work then to say that everything is contingent.
I think that that's absolutely right. And what I'm trying to show this. And so when you say everything is contingent, all you're really saying is that the series as a whole is without a cause. The moment someone admits the existence of a contingent thing, at that very moment he must admit the existence of a series of such things, right? And once it is admitted that a series of such things exists, one must ask about the nature of the series as a whole. It is redundant to insist that everything in the contingent series is caused, but we still must ask, is the series as a whole without a cause? Or is the series itself caused by another? The only way the critic of this argument can counter this point is to show that it is meaningless to ask about the nature of the whole series. And I find it impossible to prove that. On the contrary, as we will soon see, it is necessary to make such an inquiry. So you can't just say, well, everything is contingent. And now I want to say, wait a minute. Well, what about the series as a whole? Is that contingent? Is the series as a whole contingent?
So if it goes on forever, they say it doesn't matter. And that's where the meaningless comes in, right?
Yeah.
Does it solve our argument? That gets us nowhere.
And what I think that the atheist is always doing this, and I'm going to show that when we come back after break and all that, and we go through the objections, I'm going to pull out quotes from atheist literature that show you this. They are always converting this argument to a denial of a temporal infinite regress in the past. In other words, they are constantly converting this argument into an argument for a beginning of the universe. It doesn't matter that I've set it up this way. They just keep doing that. And they're right. I mean, as far as this argument is concerned, it doesn't matter if the past is eternal. And so it could just keep going on and forever and ever. And in that sense, everything comes into existence from something else. You could say that sort of thing. But as far as this is concerned, this is an essentially ordered series of contingent effects. And here's the question. Is the series as a whole contingent? Is the series as a whole needing a cause? Or is it itself uncaused? And if you say that the series as a whole exists without a cause, it would mean that the series is simply uncaused, but how can that be? Are we saying that there is no causality going on in the series? Is that what we're saying? If that is what we're saying, then option one cannot be true, for we have already seen that contingent things have causes. And this is a series of contingent things. So you can't say that there's no causality going on in the series. And if the series is a series of contingent things, then there must be causality going on in the series. And therefore, perhaps option one simply implies that while there are individual things in the series that are caused, when we add an infinite number of them together, we end up with an uncaused series. Maybe that's what they're trying to say. But this understanding of option one is also closed to us, for adding caused things together will not equal an uncaused entity. Indeed, two caused things added together equals a couple of effects. And so it hardly seems impossible to add an infinite number of effects together to equal anything that is an infinite number of effects or contingencies. Right? As F.C. Coppleston said in his debate with Bertrand Russell, if you add up chocolates together, you get chocolates after all and not a sheep. If you add up chocolates to infinity, you just get an infinite number of chocolates. So if you add up contingent things to infinity, you still get contingent beings. It's not like they changed their metaphysical nature just by adding an infinite number of them together. Maybe option one is telling us that there is causality going on in the series and it is impossible to add effects together to equal something that is uncaused. However, while there is causality within the series, there is this kind of as a whole dimension to the series that exists without a cause. And this as a whole dimension causes the existence of contingent things in the series. While this interpretation of option one might be plausible, it is hardly different from the option two, which states that there is something uncaused existing outside the infinite number of caused causes. Indeed, is this as a whole dimension to the series of contingent causes of being distinct from the series, or is it a part of the series? If the former, then we have embraced option two. If the latter, then the as a whole dimension to the series of contingent things is itself just another member of the series. But if it is just one more member of the series of contingent causes, then it is not really uncaused. It is just another contingent thing that needs a cause. We conclude then that option one either entails an impossibility or gives us little more than a veiled expression of option two. If every member of this series is contingent, then what is the whole? Contingent. All right. So, is the cause of the whole series caused to exist by another? It can't be. Why?
Everything within that is contingent.
Okay. If you're going to be the cause of the whole series, then you yourself can't need a cause. Because if you were caused, or if you were contingent, then you would just be part of the series.
What's more, if it's an infinite series, then you would have to also be an infinite cause.
We're not going there yet. Sorry. I'm going to scratch that. We don't know what this uncaused thing is. We don't even know if there's only one of them, right? We just know there has to be an uncaused thing, right? So if the series of contingent effects is infinite, we know one thing for sure. There is a whole that has to be explained for, because if every member of the series is contingent, the whole is. So you have to have a cause of the whole series to be reasonable, to be rational. It doesn't make sense for you to say that the whole series exists without a cause, or the series as a whole exists without a cause. It doesn't make any sense to say that.
So somebody started an infinite chain.
Not necessarily. There's an uncaused thing that is currently sustaining the existence of an infinite number of contingent beings.
Okay, so this isn't a question of beginning.
This is not a question of beginnings and ends. The universe could be contingent for eternity. It doesn't matter. It is eternally contingent. And if it's eternally contingent, then it needs a cause to keep it in being right now.
This might be a silly question. But looking at this link of contingent events, is it at all possible, this may again be a stupid question, is it at all possible for there to exist in that link, so say you have contingent, uncaused, mm-hmm. contingent, is it okay. possible to have a non-contingent link in that, and say you have one of them, or maybe even two of them, but the rest of the chain that continues on is contingent?
Quick answer, an atheist doesn't want to go there.
Okay.
Why? Because when you're talking about an uncaused thing, you're definitely talking about something that's metaphysically distinct from all the other contingent things. So it doesn't matter where you place it, because it's still a cause of the whole series. They all find their grounding in that uncaused link. Right?
Because the difference is causality, not causality.
Right. Let's put it another way, and this is actually the third reason I give for saying that there must be an uncaused cause. Let's say you say there can be no uncaused cause, and you have this infinite series of contingent effects. What you're really saying at that point is that there is at least one link in the chain, say this guy right here, this one link in the chain, there is at least one that is responsible for all the causality going on in the series. Right? Well, if you're saying that, and you're saying there's no uncaused thing, then you're saying that the link, that one little link in the chain, is responsible for all the causality going on outside of itself as well as within itself. Because see, it too needs a cause. And that's a self-caused thing. And that's impossible. So your only hope at that point is to say, okay, there's a link in the chain, but it is uncaused. Ah, well then you just proved my point. I don't care where you put the uncaused cause. It doesn't matter. The point is that there's something that is uncaused. Now, there is one last final act of desperation of the person who wants to get rid of this argument. And that's, I talk about it on the bottom of page 149 and 150. And it basically goes like this. The skeptic walks up and says, hey, you know what the problem with this whole argument is? You've been assuming all along that there's a series of contingent effects. How do you know that you are dependent upon oxygen for your existence? Maybe you're a contingent effect, but you just don't know what your cause is. Maybe there's no causal connection between any two contingent things. So in other words, what we have is a contingent thing here, 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 and we have an infinite number of contingent things out there. Excuse me. My microphone just fell off. We have an infinite number of contingent things out there, and not a single one is causally linked to another single one.
We know experientially that's not true, though.
Okay, but let's play this game with the skeptic. Okay, I want to play this game.
There's no point in playing it if we know it's not true.
Actually, there's a very good point of playing it, because the skeptic has just shot himself in the foot. Because let's say this hypothetically that that's true. That experientially, we just don't know what we're talking about. Our experience has not delivered a single thing to us that we can trust about causality. So we're admitting that contingent things exist. For example, I'm admitting that I could not exist and all of that stuff. But there's no causal link between me and anything else. So that what we have is an infinite number of disparate and separated contingent things floating around existence. Here's the problem with that. We just established in the previous premises that contingent things undeniably exist, and that every contingent thing needs a cause. And therefore, if there's no series of contingent things, each contingent thing causing the other contingent thing, then that means that immediately there's an uncaused cause for every single one of those contingent effects. Now, some of you might say, well, you just proved polytheism or something. Fine. My point here is not to prove that there's only one uncaused cause. I will. But that's not my point here. My point here is to establish the existence of at least one uncaused cause. And therefore, even if you were to say to me, that series of contingent effects that you've conjured up in your head is just a fig Newton of your imagination, my contingency is not a fig Newton of my imagination. And therefore, if you want to say that I am not causal or related to any contingent thing, you've basically cut out the middleman and gone directly for the uncaused cause. Because that's your only hope. You can't say that the cause of all contingent reality is self-caused. Now, maybe there's an infinite number of uncaused causes. In other words, there's an uncaused cause for every contingent effect that exists. Or maybe there's only one. Maybe there's an oligarchy of them. You know, because we've not even demonstrated that this uncaused cause is personal. We've only demonstrated that there is an uncaused cause. Maybe there's one. Maybe there's an infinite number of them. Who cares? What we've proven is that every contingent thing here screams out for an explanation, and that explanation must ultimately reside in an uncaused cause. Go ahead.
Does that model work if you change the definition of contingency? So if we're no longer speaking about contingent things, which I don't know how you get there, mm-hmm. but is it possible to give that same kind of model that there exists, in other words, these little islands of things, maybe not contingent things? So if you change the definition of what it means to be contingent, does that model still work?
Well, probably not. I mean, you can take any word and give a new definition for it. But a rose by any other name smells just as sweet. You could say a blark is what is limited, changing, and dependent. And therefore, blarks exist because I'm blark, you're blark. You know, I mean, in other words, take if you want to get into the semantic word game, that's fine. But I'm taking a word that has been historically used in this way. This is how it's been used. And given your experience of the way the world works, you must admit that it's contingent. Everything that you encounter in this world is contingent. Well, I mean, fine, take the word contingent, give it another definition, in which case it wouldn't apply to our experience because you've given another definition. Well, I can just take another word, infuse it with meaning, ground it in our experience, and still give the same argument. At that point, I don't really think it matters. Yeah.
So the important part is that the logical concept remains unchanged, even if the label might shift.
Sure. Because this is an argument grounded in our experience, that's what makes it so powerful, because we're experiencing ourselves as contingent things. And the mere fact that something exists and that something is contingent proves that there has to be something uncaused. All right. I know that we've gone way over. And I told you we'd get to premise D. So why don't we take a 5-minute break, and then we will start up again and just go for the next hour and finish this out. So.